Okay, well, in some sense, this is a repeat of the last two talks, somewhat ambitious. In the first half, I'd like to talk about quantum Hall sightings in quasi-three-dimensional bulk crystalline materials. And in the last part of the talk, I'll discuss a similar multiple quantum well system, as was discussed in the previous talk. Okay, so the question... Well, before I go into that, let me just say that one of the sort of the themes of the of our plots down in Tallahassee is, you know, how do you go from two-dimensional to three-dimensional systems? What are the relationship between these strongly coupled quantum well structures and the molecular conductors, which also look a lot like multiple quantum well systems? So the systems that I'll be talking about in terms of the semiconductors will be highly, very highly coupled 200-layer systems. Okay, so the question is, in an organic conductor like Victor talked about, can you see this kind of behavior? Can you see quantization of the Hall resistance? Can you see rho xx start to drop to zero, let's say the I equal 1 quantum Hall plateau? And can you see rho zz or gzz, which is 1 over rho zz, increase when you're in the quantum Hall state? Can you see that in a quasi-three-dimensional molecular crystal? Okay, the answer is, well, yeah. Depends. Very briefly, organic chemistry, there's a donor and an acceptor, and these two particular donors are the most popular and feed most people in this field. As Victor also pointed out, there's the quasi-1D systems, they're chains, the chains are coupled. All of the materials I'm going to talk about in terms of molecular crystals are really quasi-2D and to the in the third direction, a little bit quasi-3D. Most of them are 2D. Okay. The first really robust, in my opinion, the first really robust report of a quantum Hall effect or an integer Hall effect, to be more general, in these low-dimensional systems was by Cooper et al. And Hannes et al. And PRL in 1989 in this famous PF6 material. Of course, these materials, you should know, you have to put silver paint, and gold, you know, silver paint contacts and gold wires on some little crystal, which is sometimes kind of crumbly and small and cracked and whatever, and then cram it in a pressure bomb and pray that you can get to 10 kilobar to still have some meaningful results. And another theme along those lines is the meaning of sigma xx, sigma xy, sigma yy, sigma zz, all of those tensor components, they're still a little bit ambiguous in these systems. But anyway, a little later on, after this quantum Hall or integer Hall effect was discovered, Zikang and one of my students, Sven Velfels, decided to see if the Wei-type scaling worked. You know, if there's a quantum Hall effect, is there some kind of scaling? The answer is not really. Okay, the complication is that these materials have a spin density wave phase, and the quantum Hall behavior or integer Hall behavior appears inside these density wave phases. Okay. Nevertheless, one can push ahead and measure risers in rho xy and widths in rho xx and try to do some kind of scaling and see what's going on. Okay, so the problem with these systems, or the beauty of these systems, is that the quantum Hall behavior in the quasi-1D systems lies below this second-order phase transition where the gap opens up. And within, below the second-order line, there's a series of different spin density wave phases with slightly different order parameters. Okay, so to go from one of these subphases, from this subphase to that subphase, you're going from one order parameter to another. Okay, so that's the complication. The result was that if you look at the risers and the widths of the of these transitions, you find that the slopes at the transitions in rho xx or rho xy go linearly into the transition temperature and not go linearly in and then flatten out at low temperatures, and it's similar for the widths. Okay, so you don't have the Wei scaling; you have something totally different. Or somewhat different. Okay. To make a long story short, The quantum Hall effect in these systems has been described in terms of a quantized nesting vector. The Fermi level is always in a spin density wave gap. Okay? And so the system always adjusts itself, so the Fermi level is in that gap. And instead of the Landau levels crossing the Fermi level like in the normal 2D system, this nesting vector is quantized, and it's clicking, 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 always to keep the level in the gap. And that's thought to, well, that pins the Fermi level, and that gives you the quantum Hall or the integer Hall effect. You can go through an argument involving length scales and whatnot, and if the gap is BCS-like, you can describe the behavior of the risers or the widths as a function of temperature in terms of a model where essentially the widths go like linear in a negative slope in B as you go into the SDW transition. Okay, so this treatment by Valfels et al. Pretty much addresses the question of the temperature dependence of the details of the changes in the transport in the integer Hall effect in these quasi-1D systems. ρZZ or RZZ was measured in a different experiment by Uji. Again, you can see the way people are thinking in this field. There's a little sample. It's, you know, maybe 10,000 or 100,000 layers of two-dimensional conductor. Again, in a slightly different material, there is a second-order phase transition below which there are a family of different spin density wave states. And in this system, RZZ was measured, and in agreement with results that Yakovenko showed by Kang et al., RZZ has its jumps at the Hall transitions, not in the plateaus. So there's something fundamentally different, unless, of course, the experiment is amiss in terms of what you would expect for ρZZ. In other words, it's not a maximum in the Hall plateau, it's at the transition. And there's two experiments that show this, so this seems fundamentally different than what one might expect in a real quasi-2D multiple-layer system. Again, there's all kinds of analysis one can do of the various resistances, I won't go into it, or conductivities, as these states develop and as you go to lower temperatures. Again, the same temperature dependence was seen by Uji et al. That was seen by Valfels et al. In some characteristic width parameter. Okay. One of the themes here is that these systems seem to have some weird ground state, spin density wave or charge density wave. There's another system. It's a bronze system. It's not really a bronze, but it's in that family. And again, as you go down in temperature, it goes through two charge density wave transitions. And so the Fermi surface that you have at room temperature, which consists in this case of three crossed 1D conducting systems, at low temperatures, this Fermi surface reconstructs twice. And at, you know, 4 degrees, you have tiny, tiny little pockets that reach the quantum limit by 20 Tesla. So you have a quasi-2D system. There's a charge density wave hanging around. But you have these tiny, tiny little pockets remaining at various points in the Brillouin zone. Okay. Now, this system is a little more encouraging. Again, I point out that these samples are never perfect. They're never like a gallium arsenide or a silicon device. They're always, you know, there's always some strange things if you look under the microscope. And it's hard to get leads on them in a really precise way. Nevertheless, I think Steve Hill has made a lot of progress in looking at these materials, this particular material, and trying to understand these weird current paths and these weird mixings of the different parts of the tensor. Okay, so in this graph, you can see a rho xy or an rxy that actually does have quasi-Hall plateaus. If you measure the sample, you measure the unit cell, you do all the normal things to figure out, you know, how many carriers you have per layer, you get reasonable agreement, say, if you call this nu equal 1, reasonable agreement with, you know, eclipsing to within a factor of 2 or 4, depending on the spin degeneracy, how accurately you can measure the sample and whatnot. In all of these materials, it comes out close. You have reasonable confidence that something is I equal 1 or I equal 2. I think you can go that far. But still, there's some mixing of the, there's some uncertainties and some mixing of the various transport properties. Okay, Steve, I'm sorry for the complexity of this. Steve has, one of the least ambiguous things you can do is put a lead on the top and the bottom of the sample. There you know that the current The electric field is, the current is going through all of the layers. And that's what this is. And that shows what I'll call RZZ. And here, let's call this the I equal 1 Hall plateau. And RZZ certainly has a peak, which means GZZ would have a minimum. So this is looking like, this is starting to look like the quantum well structures. However, in RXX, you still see some mixing. When you try to put current in plane, you always have the possibility, if there's some crack or something, that the current makes its way up and down through the sample as well as through. So there's always mixing going on. But I think Steve's done a reasonably good job of separating that out. So in this molybdenum oxide system, which has a CDW, which has some hysteresis like all these systems have, the nesting vector may be moving around a little bit, it seems to be reasonably promising that you're measuring something like that. Now, let's go to a different system. This is the ET system, and it's a layered system. So this is a conducting plane, about 13 angstroms. And this is an anion layer, which is about 7 angstroms. That really kind of looks like a quantum well or a heterostructure or something. But it's, you know, on a much smaller scale. Okay? There have been reports of quantum Hall-like behavior in these materials. Now, here the Fermi energy is a lot larger. The quantum level you get to is only about 20 or 30. The Landau level you get to at, say, 30 or 40 Tesla. Nevertheless, there are some encouraging signs here. Okay. The Oxford group at Leuven actually did some magnetization measurements. What we're looking at is magnetization, a coil wrapped around a little crystal. And we're looking at high fields, and the field is rapidly moving. Now, the magnetization measures the bulk thermodynamic magnetization or moment of the sample. And if there's any currents running around the edges of the sample, which may create an extra moment, it will measure those too. So a dynamic magnetization measurement will measure both the thermodynamic and transport properties. Now, I'll let you read the papers by Singleton, Harrison, Honnold et al. And they'll try to convince you that they're seeing some chiral edge state behavior in these materials. Again, imagine a tiny little crystal, you know, quasi-2D, many, many layers, and imagine current either being able to go, you know, through the sample or around the edges. Okay? They do various kinds of modeling, and they try to convince you that they're seeing the chiral behavior. Okay? In a static measurement by the same group, you have to have the field up, you have to have the field down, you have to take the difference. They also see at high fields some evidence for the waveforms in the Shubnikov-Haas effect and in the Hall effect change in accordance with their model, which says that there's some edge state phenomena, there's some quantum Hall behavior. Okay? The basic argument they make, and again, I'll let you look at their papers and they can convince you, is the following. They say, well, this has both a two-dimensional and a one-dimensional Fermi surface. That's the characteristic description of the electronic structure of these materials. And the 1D orbits serve as the reservoir. That's where the electrons can go when there's a Landau gap in the 2D bands. Okay, and they make various arguments that say that that's how it goes, and that's why the data looks the way it is. Another thought is by Steve Hilligan, who did some DC measurements and looked at waveforms. And I'll just point out that this idea is persistent in the literature now, that when you're in a Landau gap, the current has a hard time going through the center of the sample. Maybe it goes around the edges. And you may be able to interpret the waveforms, these complicated Shubnikov waveforms, in that sense. One little caveat here, these systems have a crazy ground state, which is still highly controversial and emotional. And I don't have time to talk about that. In a system that doesn't have this crazy, stupid ground state, which gets everybody all mad, we've very carefully looked at the magnetization and the transport simultaneously. This also has 2D and 1D bands. And we don't see this crazy effect. We don't see we don't see evidence for, you know, chiral behavior. Okay?
What is
this? This is a BEDT TTF 2 MHG SEN4. It's that beautiful picture I showed you. It's a quasi-2D conductor which has the unique feature that it has both 2D band, a 2D band and a 1D band. And that also has fed many people for many years. Okay. Time rushes on. So let me just say what one of the bottom lines are here. There is an integer Hall effect. I won't say a quantum Hall effect, but an integer Hall effect. And it agrees reasonably well with eclipsing to within a factor of, say, less than 10. I'm trying to be honest, and I'm trying to be, many of these systems are small pockets, and that's where your closed orbits or your two-dimensional electron gas is coming from, okay? And it's sometimes SDW, sometimes CDW. And depending on who you talk to, maybe some of them are metallic and maybe not, okay? You get behavior in the transport properties, which seem to be tied to the density wave order parameter. And the concept of the 1D band being the pinner, or the concept of the SDW or CDW being the pinner, is something that's of interest to look into further. Okay, and I won't say in all cases now because Victor scolded me. ROZZ or RZZ sometimes appears where it should in the Hall state and sometimes doesn't. Okay, but there's some the preponderance of evidence is that there is something going on, both in integer Hall or quantum Hall and also in chiral behavior or edge state behavior. So I think that's going to be the message when people do more and more careful measurements. Okay, let me now quickly pass on to the next part of the talk, looking at the organic conductors and saying, well, darn, these systems are a little wild. Let's go back and look at something that's easier to understand. Jerry Simmons and co-workers at Sandia made some 200-layer quantum well structures for us. These are highly coupled. I don't have time to go through all of the characteristics in detail. And we all know that experimental problems can really cause havoc. But they are, the mobilities are around 6,000. They're similar to the structures that Stirmer had, but they're many, many more layers. And our bandwidths are small. And so they're very highly coupled systems. We've looked at less highly coupled systems, but these are the highly coupled systems. We go to Sydney to have them processed. When we want to do mesas, we go to Nancy Lumpkin. And she takes a thing, and she just etches down a certain distance and puts actually two terminals on top, two terminals on the bottom, so we can do four terminal RZZ measurements. Of course, it's not on the same sample, but it's on the same wafer. Okay, and we can look at the good old RXX and RXY for the I equal 2 or the nu equal 1. And this is what the data looks like. And if you look very, very carefully, you can see that the RXX does not really go to 0 at nu equal 1. It's always finite. Okay. Let's just talk about a few other features of this. There's the low field part, which if this is really a quasi-3D metal, it ought to have a warped Fermi surface cylinder behavior. But we do see evidence for beading and things like that that indicate that you might have a warped Fermi surface cylinder, which means they have a finite bandwidth in the Z direction. Okay, we're worried about quantization. And this is what ZQ did to me. He's a theorist, so he doesn't care. You know, he said, is it really quantized? And how many layers are there? So we did AC measurements, we did DC measurements, we had the field up, we had the field down, we did it 10 million times. And we see that every layer participates in the quantization. So within our experimental error, all 200 layers are there, full blast. And when we really press our instrumentation, it looks like it's quantized and all 200 layers participate. Okay, we are really worried about the fact that there's some residual resistivity, which no matter what we do, we can't get rid of. Filters, you know, it's that old problem of the low temperature. Where's the electron gas, really? We did all kinds of, tests and everything, but we always, at low temperatures, this is the minimum at nu equal 1 in rho xx versus temperature. At very low currents, it always comes in around 2 ohms or so in this, in real measured parameters. And there's just no way we can get rid of it. So there's always that lingering thought when you go to bed, maybe there's a radio station next door or something. Nevertheless, if this were really a gap state, this ought to go screaming down. But it screams down for a while and it bends over. And as was reported in the previous talk, the gap that one finds here is very small. In fact, the gap that one finds here, if you consider activation, is about the bandwidth divided by 200. So it may be related to the number of layers. Okay. Pardon?
Per layer is 2 ohms.
2 ohms total. Total. Okay. And since you asked that point, the other paranoid thought is, oh, there's parallel conductance, you know, and your student has wired the top, you know, one side to the other with a piece of copper wire that you didn't know about, or spilled their, I guess down south it's Mountain Dew on it. So we went to Pengjiang up on campus, and we had to put a gate on top. And so we put a gate on top, and we gated it with negative voltage. And if you put too much voltage on, the gate tunnels, so you get heating. But what we could see is we could deplete the system layer by layer. And as we depleted it, rho XX went up about half an ohm. This is total. And so we concluded from this, I won't go into the argument, so we don't have parallel conductance. Okay, let me finish now with the most important part. Okay, so we measure, I'll say RXX, RXY, and RZZ. And this is at zero angle versus temperature over a certain range. And our general results are in, I would say, reasonable agreement with the previous brilliant Santa Barbara group's results. But let me point out one thing. If you follow this RXX at zero angle, you get essentially an activated behavior here with a very small gap and a Coulomb gap behavior down here. And the student Biao has fit these things to chi-squareds of, you know, 10 to the minus 6 or whatever. So we fit the data in two regions. You've seen this kind of plot before. One behavior here and another behavior here. I'll summarize that in a minute. And then we can go to tilted angles. We've done many, many angles. And the bottom line is when you go tilting away, this looks more like a power wah than it does a gap. But this still is like a Coulomb gap at low temperatures. Okay. The same is true for GZZ. Without going into details, you know, in this position, it looks like gap, Coulomb gap, in the 36 degrees or in tilt, power law, Coulomb gap. This is terrible to do to the audience, but just to drive the point home, the activation, this formula fits quite well the high temperature data. The low temperature data and the low temperature limit, it looks more like a Coulomb gap behavior. When you tilt the sample, it goes from Coulomb gap to power law. And student Biao swears that the chi-squares are excellent. Okay, coming back to the tilted behavior, we've done the resistance versus temperature for the tilted behavior. And it's non-monotonic. I won't go into the details. There seems to be some optimum angle outside the error of our orientation where this residual resistivity is a minimum. Okay, let's go to the, actually Professor Chalker was mentioning this earlier, let's go to the tilt again in a different way. You tilt the sample, you sweep the field, and of course you see the nu equal 1 move out as you tilt the field. Okay, so you think, I'll just scale this to be perpendicular, and everything's going to line up perfectly. Well, it doesn't. If I look at rho x y, or rx y, rxx, and then the difference, I find that there's a non-trivial difference in, say, rho xx or rxx when you scale the data to be perpendicular. So something else is going on. They don't line up. The gzz or rzz, you can't say gzz if you're away from 0 degrees because now you've mixed the components. What we find, and this I think addresses one of the points you made, I guess we don't see any difference in the RZZ, or if you inverted this and made it GZZ, we don't see any difference in this value, any gross difference in this value for 0 degrees versus 36 degrees in the vertical transport. Again, there's a caveat of you're now starting to mix the tensor components, and you have to be really careful what you're doing because a lot could be going on. Anyway, nevertheless, there still seems to be some non-trivial differences in the tilted versus non-tilted field results. There are some other crazy things that go on that I don't have time to mention. There's some evidence for nu equal a half coming in some of the samples and in some of the tilt angles. But let me summarize, because time is running out. So in a very highly coupled system, we can see complete quantization of the quantum Hall state. There seems to be a finite minimum resistivity in the center of the state within our experimental error. And this follows an activated behavior at high temperatures and in zero tilt angle, and a Coulomb gap-like behavior at low temperatures. And the same is true for RZZ when plotted as GZZ. Okay? We don't think we see any depletion, any parallel conductance in the samples. We think the samples are very good and very highly coupled. I think there's a very interesting relationship or undiscovered relationship between RXX and RZZ or GZZ. It seems that there's some connection. They seem to follow each other in the temperature dependence, which is very intriguing. Okay. Tilted magnetic fields produce non-trivial changes that cannot be just described as scaling with a B perpendicular field. So the B parallel field, or I guess in Chakra it was B perp, in our language it's B parallel, but the in-plane field may be having non-trivial effects on the system. Okay? And this is under further investigation. Thank you. The why did the gated sample show there was no parallel conductance? There was a fear that this cap layer, the very top layer, which was carefully engineered to make sure there was no weird band bending as you went from that last quantum well, number 200, up, that wasn't depleted. So Jerry Simmons designed that very carefully so that there would be good matching and that level wouldn't be depleted. So I was worried that in that top cap layer there might be some residual, you know, essentially like a quasi 2D layer of dopant that was contributing in some way to the to shorting out or giving you finite dissipation. I was looking for finite dissipation somewhere. And so what we could do, what was suggested, was to gate it, to try to push that out, get rid of it. And what we saw is that the minimum resistivity, or RXX at nu equal 1, always went up as we gated. As we depleted, it went up. It never went down. We never killed any parallel conducting path.
You're reducing the conductance path. You're pushing it to the next layer.
There's some subtleties about that data that I think need more attention. There's actually some rather interesting things going on there. But the conventional wisdom in that community, at least in the Sandia area, is that if you gate that sample and resistance goes down, you've got crud that's giving you a parallel conducting path. If the resistance goes up, then that's something else. You could
don't have any explanation
for
why it goes up.
Well, if RXX and GZZ are talking to each other, if there's some connection between them, then that might give a hint. And the only reason I can say that maybe they are is their temperature dependence seems to be diabolically similar.
Wouldn't you just expect it to change by one part 200? I mean, if RXX was some bulk effect and you eliminated one layer, it should change by a part 200. Here it's changing by a very significant amount, so something is happening near the top. I don't know what's happening.
What about the quantization, though? I mean, clearly we're digging not just into the top; we're digging down, you know, four layers. Where the electric field is sufficient to go down four layers. So it's not just the top. I'm sorry. This is RXY. This is a hall.
It's changing by a very small amount, but it looked like the...
No, it's changing by one layer.
Yeah, okay, right. One part 200 each time.
Yes.
But the other one is changing by 0.5 ohms. I thought
yeah.
A total of 2.
Right, well... Yeah,
so
3.2. It's not point. It's 0.05. Sorry, 0.05.
Oh, okay, all right.
Is that going to go out to 300,000 people?
Yeah.
0.05. Sorry.
I have a quick question, both for this stuff and the last stuff. What about the zero field transport properties? I mean, does the zero field resistance, its temperature dependence, and so on, behave like mini band transport in a superlattice in just ordinary Boltzmann theory?
The zero field transport looks like this. It well, the organic conductors ate half my transport. It looks like this. It comes down, it goes up, and then it goes like that. Yeah.
Okay, that's what should happen.
That's what it does. There's a weak temperature dependence down here.